Pulitzer Prize-winning author, artist, screenwriter, playwright Jules Feiffer has had a career that spans 7 decades. His internationally syndicated cartoon, Feiffer, ran for 42 years in the Village Voice. In 2004, he was inducted into the Comic Book Hall of Fame. Feiffer has written more than 35 books, plays, and screenplays, and he's illustrated classic children's books, including The Phantom Tollbooth. Now in his third graphic novel, titled The Ghost Script, Feiffer completes a fast-paced noir crime trilogy that began with Kill My Mother and Cousin Joseph. Set in Hollywood against the backdrop of McCarthyism, The Ghost Script follows Detective Archie Goldman as he searches for a screenplay containing revelations about the true motivations behind the Hollywood blacklist. The Ghost Script is published by Live Right, and I'm happy to welcome Jules Feiffer to our show.
Hi, thank you, and that was a nice, good-sized pressie. Now I know what the book is about.
Yeah, and you have quite a career. So you've been doing cartooning for
since I was born.
And then what made you start the graphic novel? So your first one was in 2014. What made you pick that up?
Look at me. I got old. I lost my hearing. I could not write plays anymore because you have to be in rehearsal to understand what the actors are saying.
I mean,
it all became so difficult to continue the life that I had been leading. So I moved out to the Hamptons and started fiddling around with different forms that I might work with. And I had always loved noir from the time of the 40s when it began in movies, and before that with Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett, all of whose works I've revered. So it seemed a natural to try to do a book based on the past, but dealing with the present and, you know, on the sidelines.
So
and using noir as a way of doing it, and it turned out to be my introduction to graphic novels, which I had never thought of doing before. And I loved the form. And after the first scary experience with Kill My Mother, where every page that I drew became a nervous breakdown because I was convinced I didn't know what I was doing, only because I didn't know what I was doing.
Really, after all of these years of drawing?
Well, it was all, you know, because I was never content to do the same thing. I wanted to spread out and do different things, not because for any particular reason other than I got bored easily. And if I knew how to do it, there was no reason to continue doing it.
Right. And did you always love the graphic novel? Or?
Well, I loved comic books when I was a kid, before there were graphic novels. And I particularly loved the work of a man named Milton Caniff, who did a revered strip called Terry and the Pirates when I was a little boy. And I loved the work of a cartoonist named Will Eisner, who created something called The Spirit, again when I was a boy. And those were the two cartoonists who mostly represented my unofficial mentorship, because I didn't know them at the time, and who I worshipped. And later I was fortunate enough to work for Eisner on his classic comic strip, The Spirit, and ended up being strongly influenced by him and being his ghostwriter on The Spirit. So I had a long experience in that form before I became the cartoonist on The Village Voice that people knew me for. And so I worked in those more or less realistic-based stories and knew how to do them and knew how to write them. But I had graduated into another form of, you know, of social and political satire, where I was much too busy trying to overthrow the government to bother with comic books.
And so let's talk about your career with The Village Voice. It spanned many decades, and you say, I listened to an interview with you, you say that you didn't get paid for those cartoons.
The first 20 years, they didn't pay me. And by that time, I was also in syndication, so I was making a little money. But when I went into Dan Wolf, who was the editor of the paper and someone I revered, and I said, you have to start paying me, and he said, you're an icon. What do you want money for? And I said, icons have to eat.
But you first went to The Village Voice because you couldn't get anyone else to pick up your cartoons.
Well, because what I was doing was so unusual and also politically out of sorts with the time, because we were in, not just McCarthy was over, but this was post-McCarthyism. and Eisenhowerism, which lasted a very long time. And there were still loyalty oaths and people getting fired for having the wrong opinions on the job. And people, young college-educated people of my age or younger or some older, who were afraid to share their opinions publicly because they might get in trouble with their careers. So all of this fear was laced through the generation that I was coming up in, and I was intent on commenting on it and writing about it, but also writing about other things like relationships between parents and children, between boys and girls, young men and young women, who I was one of, and how they... And I was particularly interested in language as a form of non-communication, how we did not communicate, how we spoke in order not to tell the truth, but to manipulate each other, or you know, and sometimes innocently, as with a lot of relationships that were going on, sometimes with family between parents and children, who found ways of having conversations that always deceived, that the way of talking in order not to communicate became the theme of much of my work and remains that to this very moment.
Right, and the Village Voice didn't edit you. They let you say what you wanted to say. Is that correct?
The miracle of the voice in those years is created by Dan Wolf and Ed Fancher and Jerry Tolmer at the time. It was the only newspaper, because it was a very tiny newspaper, that let its contributors, its writers, its cartoonists, its whoever, its critics, say whatever they wanted to say without editorial judgment. And sometimes it was good stuff, and sometimes it didn't make any sense, but they put stuff in the paper. It became the voice of a whole generation of up-and-coming young people who didn't feel that they were part of the general culture at the time. And while the editors and publishers of The Voice had no personal axes to grind, and they were not left-wingers by any means, they opened themselves to all of this, the beats and the this and the that and all sorts of new stuff that was coming on. And their editor, Jerry Tolmer, also helped discover and promulgate Off-Broadway. He never got the credit he deserved for it. They were some remarkable people.
I'm speaking with Jules Pfeiffer about his new graphic novel, The Ghost Script. Jules, is there a place that exists today for cartoonists that can have that freedom of voice?
Well, you're talking to an old guy. I don't know this. but there were people online doing stuff that they want to do, and they have freedom to do that. And I suppose they were all agencies. I found the graphic novel that I got into rather late a form of immense freedom, and there's some extraordinary... I mean, what thrilled me is there were a bunch of younger cartoonists who followed me and were influenced me, who, when I got into the business of the graphic novel, I began to be influenced by, and I began stealing from them. So it's a round robin of influence, and that excites me in terms of any art, but this form in particular.
And so the books have a very film noir aesthetic, and they're set during the anti-communist witch hunts of the 1950s. What do you think makes that era so conducive to a graphic novel?
Well, it wasn't conducive to a graphic novel. It was conducive to me. It was a generation I was brought up in. It was formed my politics and my art, and my outlook. When I just got out of the Army in 1953, I went down to Foley Square to hear Jerome Robbins testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee, and watched how he was beaten down and humiliated by the committee and named names. And I felt upset for him because he was so clearly humiliated and clearly aware of the anger out there on the times of the committee and the people who ran the right-wing politics of the time, of the anti-Semitism implied and the rage at the arts. And from that day to this, my politics have been formed by what I saw at that time, the deliberate subjugation of citizens to deprive them of making a living. And who can imagine that? And I still can't imagine that. And it went on for a long time, went on for many, many years. It started in the 40s and was still going on in the mid-50s.
Do you see any similarities to our current political atmosphere?
No. Well, you know, the difference is that this time around we've elected Joe McCarthy president, and must deal with the consequences of it, and how we do that, and how we get through that, we will know a little more about in a few months in November.
And so, why not start making cartoons again?
Because I've done that, and I'm an old guy, and there were a lot of young people around who were doing perfectly good work. But the other reason is that when I was doing my cartoon, I thought I was in the business because I could help change things and modify things. And outside of making my audience, my readers, feel better because they shared a point of view, and that helped, I found that I didn't change a damn thing, and I got tired of feeling ineffectual and having created illusions for myself that really didn't work. So I got more involved with theater. I got into the world of children's books, deciding that having poisoned the minds of one generation, I could start poisoning the minds of a younger one. And I loved that for a while, and I'm now about to have a sequel published of my most popular book for kids, was a picture book called Bark George. And in a few months, the sequel, first of two sequels, will come out called Smart George. So I'm delighted to be back doing that. But the form of the graphic novel, which I stumbled into because I was helpless to do anything else, is really the joy of my life now. And I'm going to start a series when I can, of sci-fi fantasy graphic novels for younger readers.
Wow, so you are not done. And you also wrote the screenplay for a film called Bernard and Huey, which was released in June.
That's right. All of this by accident. A young producer-director named Dan Mervish, with no money at all, somehow knows how to raise money and turn out work. And he found a script I had done called Bernard and Huey that I'd written for Showtime, and it was supposed to be produced, and then Showtime changed hands, and the first thing companies do when they change hands is cancel everything that the previous ownership did, and nobody wanted to buy it after that until some 25, 30 years later. Dan Mervish came along and discovered it, and he's done his version of it, which is I think, for, you know, it cost him $1.50, and he's got some wonderful actors in it, and it's the best thing I've done in film on sex and relationships in Carnal Knowledge. It works beautifully.
Well, and going back to the graphic novel, the Ghost Script, it's full of plot loops and twists. Was it difficult to seamlessly weave together all of these different loose threads?
Oy vey. It was, and I went back over and over and over and over. I mean, the whole point is, in the end, you make it seem seamless, that you have to make it look easy. I've talked about this a lot in the past, but my role model in my work has always been Fred Astaire, who spent months in rehearsing to make it look as if he wasn't doing anything and anybody could do it. And that, creatively, is what I try to do. I mean, in my strips, in my plays, and in my graphic novels, to make it look as if it just flows. It's just one thing organically goes into another. But to do that, you have to write and rewrite and throw things out and edit and take things you love and destroy them and move it along. And it's very challenging. And at the same time, I always have seen it as a form of play. It's a game. And you it's a sleight of hand where you're fooling the reader into going along with you by changing his perception or her perception, and whether I'm going this way, no, I'm going that way, I fooled you, and until you be able to tell the story that you want to tell, and tell it as entertainingly but as meaningfully as you know how, and make a point, and get your politics in there. But they don't know what's happening to them. You know, it's a surprise journey.
And so you work it and rework it, I guess. But
over and over and over again. When I saw the first print of the book come to me in galleys. I was shocked at how awful it was, and I had to just rework everything in a way to change this,
but you
change directions and all of that.
But you also like spontaneity. I've heard you say that you just like to just draw without having your editing tool in your head going.
No, the editing tool is the worst enemy of creativity, and I used to like to know what I was doing in advance. Now I don't want to know. But at a certain point, you don't use the brain when you create, but you start using the brain and the editing powers given you by the brain when you have to fix up the mess that you put out there and find some order for it. And that too becomes a game. You switch things, you move things around, and you do things you didn't think you'd ever do until you get it right.
So, last question. In your memoir, Back Into Forward, you said, success is nothing to sneeze at, but failure, too, offers great possibilities. What's been your most successful failure?
Well, I've been failing all my life and will continue to fail if I possibly can. I mean, failure, when I started out working and started talking about this, failure was out of style, and we were still in the period where Americans had to win. Well, since then, we've been losing for a long time, and the power of the good things about failure are recognized. The things you learn most from are not success, but failure.
Thank you for joining me today, Jules. I've been speaking with Jules Pfeiffer about his new graphic novel, The Ghost Script.